Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Ballot battle. The president and the vice president make a new and urgent push for voting rights legislation, but face an uphill fight in a divided Congress. Then the surge continues. COVID hospitalizations reach a record high as the White House rushes to ramp up at-home testing. And lockdown. We look at a Chinese city under some of the world's toughest COVID restrictions to examine the human toll of a zero COVID policy. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden and Vice President Harris both traveled to Georgia today to up the pressure on Congress to pass long-stalled voting rights legislation. Jeff Bennett begins our coverage.
President Joe Biden today with an urgent new call to protect the right to vote.
To protect our democracy, I support changing the Senate rules.
The president throwing his full support behind a one-time change to the Senate filibuster to ease passage of voting rights legislation.
I believe that the threat to our democracy is so grave that we must find a way to pass these voting rights bills. Debate them. Vote. Let the majority prevail. And if that bare minimum is blocked, we have no option but to change the Senate rules, including getting rid of the filibuster for this.
But that requires the support of all 50 Democratic senators. And West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema aren't on board. And Republicans are nearly unanimous in opposing the bills as government overreach.
It's a power grab to enable a power grab.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Democrats are promoting what he calls a fake outrage and fake hysteria on voting rights ginned up by partisans.
If my colleague tries to break the Senate to silence those millions of Americans, we will make their voices heard in this chamber in ways that are more inconvenient for the majority and this White House than what anybody has seen in living memory.
The White House insists President Biden will work in lockstep with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who promised a vote on voting rights legislation as soon as tomorrow. Schumer warns that if Republicans filibuster the effort, he'll force another vote by Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Failure is not an option for the democracy of America.
President Biden's choice of Georgia for today's major voting rights speech is no accident. It served as the cradle of the civil rights movement and home to two of the nation's most prominent civil rights leaders, Dr. King, whom the president honored today, laying a wreath at his crypt and with a visit to King's pulpit at Ebenezer Baptist Church. And the late Congressman John Lewis, who represented the district where the president delivered his address. And the state is ground zero for the current challenge. After President Biden beat former President Trump in Georgia by less than 12,000 votes in 2020, the state became one of the first to pass more restrictive voting laws. Supporters point to one measure, an additional day of early voting, as the law increasing voter access. But other provisions take aim at mail-in voting, implement stricter voter ID requirements, and limit the use of ballot drop boxes. Georgia is now one of 19 states that have passed tougher voting laws since the 2020 election. Taken together, the president has said the laws are the biggest threat to democracy since the Civil War.
Each one of the members of the Senate is going to be judged by history on where they stood before the vote and where they stood after the vote. There's no escape. So let's get back to work.
And he says he's bracing for a bruising fight ahead to take action.
In the day's other news, the number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 in the U.S. has hit a new record. There were nearly 146,000 as of today, topping the peak of 142,000 last January. Also today, Chicago teachers ended a walkout that canceled 5 days of classes. They've agreed on new COVID safety measures. And New Orleans reimposed an indoor mask mandate as it readies for visitors during Mardi Gras season. President Biden today defended his response to the pandemic. He said he is, quote, confident we're on the right track. His top COVID advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, accused a longtime critic of lying about him to gin up campaign donations. At a U.S. Senate hearing, Fauci charged that Republican Rand Paul's attacks are encouraging potential violence.
All of a sudden, that kindles the crazies out there, and I have life that threats upon my life, harassment of my family and my children with obscene phone calls because people are lying about me. So go to Rand Paul website and you see Fire Dr. Fauci with a little box that says contribute here. You can do $5, $10, $20, $100.
Fauci cited the arrest of a man in Iowa last month with an assault-style rifle. Police have said that he had a hit list with Fauci's name on it. An Arctic wave moved into New England today with sub-zero temperatures. Public schools in Boston and elsewhere canceled classes for fear of students suffering frostbite. Wind chills hit minus 72 at Mount Washington, New Hampshire. The observatory there posted an image of a fork sticking straight out from a plate of frozen spaghetti. The head of the Federal Reserve System says the U.S. economy is recovering strongly, but that inflation is now a serious threat. Jerome Powell had his Senate confirmation hearing today for a second term as Fed chair. He acknowledged the need to act with price hikes at a 40-year high.
If we have to raise interest rates more over time, we will. We will use our tools to get inflation back. And the main reason is this, that to get the kind of very strong labor market we want with high participation, it's going to take a long expansion.
Fed officials have already indicated that they expect 3 rate hikes this year. Powell's remarks indicate there could be more. North Korea claimed a successful launch today of a hypersonic missile. South Korea says the weapon was fired from a province near China and flew east into the sea, reaching 10 times the speed of sound. Around the same time, U.S. aviation officials briefly grounded some flights on the West Coast. They gave no explanation. The United Nations is appealing for a record $5 billion in humanitarian aid for Afghanistan and neighboring countries. The world body cites a looming catastrophe for 23 million people. In response, the U.S. announced $300 million in aid today. Afghanistan's international funding dried up when the Taliban took over in August. A Russian-led military alliance will begin withdrawing more than 2,000 troops from Kazakhstan. That comes as violent protests have been quelled and nearly 10,000 Kazakhs detained. The nation's president made the announcement today in a teleconference with his parliament.
The situation in all regions is stable. Thereby, the main mission of the peacekeeping forces has been successfully completed. In 2 days' time, a phased withdrawal of the contingent will begin. The withdrawal process will take no more than 10 days.
The Kazakh leader also announced new economic measures to narrow the country's wealth gap. Back in this country, the U.S. Navy will drain an underground fuel facility that's blamed for contaminated drinking water around Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. A Navy official confirmed today that the service will comply with a state order. People had long complained of tap water smelling like fuel and reported getting sick after using it. On Wall Street, tech stocks led a market rebound. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 183 points to close at 36,252. The Nasdaq rose 210 points, nearly 1.5%. The S&P 500 added 42. Still to come on the NewsHour, a member of the White House COVID response team discusses the push for testing. Chicago teachers agree to return to school after a protracted standoff. We examine the legacy of the Guantanamo Bay prison 20 years after its opening, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we reported earlier, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are stepping up their push for Democrats to pass federal voting rights legislation. Jeff Bennett is back now with two different views on the significance of their trip to Georgia today and what lies ahead.
Thanks, Judy. Well, President Biden was joined by several civil rights leaders today during his events in Atlanta. Some local voting rights advocates chose not to participate. One of those organizers joins me now, Latasha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter. It's good to have you with us. And President Biden did today the thing that you and so many other advocates have been calling on him to do, which is to inject new urgency into this push for voting rights. Why did you choose not to attend his speech today?
You know, we didn't attend his speech today. We weren't trying to be combative or antagonistic. We want his agenda to pass. We want him to actually be successful. We actually helped put him in office. But we also wanted to send a message loud and clear that the seriousness of this issue for us, that we wanted to show and send a message that it was no longer time. We were way past just a speech, that it was going to require action, that we wanted to make sure that there was a firm commitment to end or carve out the filibuster, and that there was a firm commitment from the White House to do everything within its power to pass voting rights legislation.
So what's your reaction to what you heard from the president today?
Well, I think it was a promising speech. I think we are, you know, cautiously optimistic. You know, many of the things that he said today, I think, you know, I must commend him in some ways. One of the things that he said, I think it takes it's a measure of a man to be able to acknowledge and admit, you know, when you are wrong. I think for him to say that he's been silent long enough is essentially, I'm so glad and I commend him from being able to speak to that, to give voice to that, because that's been part of our criticism for the last few months. He has also have been a staunch defender of the filibuster. He has said adamantly that he would not support moving the filibuster, that he felt the filibuster. And so to see him move his position and recognize the seriousness of this moment and also to acknowledge the work that's happening on the ground in Georgia, I thought it was promising.
When it comes to preserving access at the ballot box, so much of that work falls to people like you and groups like the one that you represent. Given the ways in which the laws have changed in Georgia, can you out-organize what you see as voter suppression?
Absolutely not. No one can. You know, I think that many of the organizers I work with are the best organizers in the country, possibly best organizers in the world, but there's only so much we can do. That is part of the reason why we have been diligent. We have been nonstop working. We've done everything that we could to really put pressure on the White House, on the Senate, on the House. We've gone back and forth to D.C. We've organized on the ground. We've protested. We've been arrested. My point is that there is no way out of this other than we have to really make some structural changes, and there has to be some federal protection, that we cannot allow people to be punished because of the way they voted or who they voted for. That is a serious, serious attack on democracy in this nation.
There is a palpable frustration I pick up when I speak to grassroots organizers like yourself. The political realities in Washington have not really changed in an iota, despite the speech that the president gave today and all of the attention he's trying to focus on voting rights right now. If nothing changes between now and Election Day, can the Biden administration, can they count on support from organizations like yours?
Let me say, the work that we're doing is not work that we're supporting because of for a political party. It's not the work that we're doing because political candidates. We are literally fighting for our lives. When we're supporting of legislation around health care, that's because we need health care. When we're supporting legislation around job access, that's because we need jobs and we need quality jobs. The truth of the matter is we are being attacked right now, that there are barriers that have been set up. And I often talk about these three strategies that the Republicans and the right they've used historically to actually impact the right to vote. That's one, creating a culture of fear. We're seeing that every single day with even with the lies, the information, the actually attacks on us. The second thing is to really be able to weaponize the administrative process. Georgia's a prime example. What we're seeing right now in my county, which is Fulton County, which is the largest, most populous county in the state of Georgia, the state is currently, the Republican parties have an effort right now to take over the election board here in the county. And the third thing is to restrict access. And we've seen that in the closing of polling sites, like we're dealing with in Lincoln County. We've seen that when we're talking about access around absentee ballot voting. And there's a bill being proposed right now in the Georgia legislature that would eliminate drop-off boxes. So we've seen this strategy. It's like a playbook that we've seen it over and over again. what it is going to take to move forward if we have to recognize that we're in a different kind of political landscape. We cannot allow to just think of this and voting rights as, oh, this is just another bill, just like as a part of another agenda. We have to see this as a fundamental need to preserve democracy in this nation. No matter where you are, who you vote for, you should not be punished. There should not be punitive measures because of the way that you voted. That is a dangerous, slippery road for us to go down.
Latasha Brown, thanks so much for sharing your perspectives with us.
Thank you for having me.
And now to one of the Republican officials tasked with implementing Georgia's new voting law. Gabriel Sterling is the chief operating officer of the Georgia Secretary of State's office. It's good to have you with us. And you are one of the few Republican officials who has pushed back against the lies that former President Donald Trump has been telling about the election that he lost. President Biden has suggested that those lies have transformed into a potent threat facing our democracy. Do you agree with that assessment?
I think lies, when it's done by a Republican losing candidate or a Democrat losing candidate, undermine overall faith in elections. And the reasons we have ballots is so we can avoid bullets. And if both sides keep on weaponizing election administration the way that they are, then we're going to have a very serious situation in the years to come.
President Biden, in his remarks today, was speaking about Republican election officials like yourself. And he said that too many people voting in a democracy is a problem for folks like you. And so they're putting up obstacles. How do you react to that?
I said it before, this kind of hyperbole, whether it's by President Trump or President Biden, is simply dangerous. And it's wrong. SB 202, the Voter Integrity Act, actually extends the number of days people can early vote. It makes it easier to request an absentee ballot and for those people to be identified as being the right person. The main thing that we want to make sure of is that every legal vote is counted and every legal voter is the one casting the vote and no illegal votes are being cast. In every single election, there's going to be illegal votes. Your job is to minimize them and make the election administration as easy as you possibly can. Many of the things he talked about today simply weren't true. We didn't have absentee ballot drop boxes authorized by law until this passed. We had emergency ones from COVID rules that we were able to have in the last election. So for the first time ever, Georgia law authorizes drop boxes. The idea that it's harder to request an absentee ballot is simply not true. In fact, we now have a way to use voter ID to make sure it's a binary system. We're no longer having to match signatures, which Democrats literally sued us last year to get rid of signature match, and now they're trying to sue us for some other ways to identify voters. We're trying to make it more secure and very, very easy to vote. It's extremely easy to vote in my state, but it's very, very hard to cheat, and that's the goal of these kind of laws.
But there are elements of the Georgia voting law that turn what had been an apolitical process into potentially a partisan one. For instance, giving the state oversight of the state election board. Why is that appropriate?
The people have so misunderstood and lied about this law that it's just becoming... I was so frustrated at the beginning of this year. I'm frustrated again now, people lying about this law. All it does is let the state election board go into where there's a failing county, where people are being abused by their election officials locally. Take Fulton County, for example, which has always been a problem. We had thousands of people did not get their absentee ballots during the primary, and that's wrong. We can't allow for that. So there has to be a mechanism of accountability. And this one, there's a lot of due process. There has to be an investigation that goes at minimum of 30 days. One of the claims is that Republicans can put in people to overturn election results. That's just impossible with the way this law is written. It's not reality. To certify an election, it goes 10 days. The investigation to be called for has to go at least 30. This hyperbole, these lies about this stuff, I know it's great politics. It really is. You know, for Trump, he thought it was great politics to claim the stolen election. For Biden, the Democrats saying voter suppression is great politics, but it undermines people's faith of both parties in the election administration, and it's just wrong.
But to lots of people, the Georgia the voting law is really a solution in search of a problem. There was no fraud in the 2020 vote in Georgia to the degree that it would have changed the outcome. What there was increased turnout. And as a result, come these stricter voting laws. Why is that? Why was that the sort of the sequence?
Well, the claim that these are stricter voting laws is somehow very bizarre to me, because our office wrote a good 90% of this law. It's really about election administration. We had a brand new voting system that was used for the first time in 2020, where we had a paper-based ballot done off a touchscreen. So we knew there's gonna be things we were gonna learn and things needed to change. We also needed to get a tighter control on the absentee ballot process, because that is one of the areas that was, for lack of a better word, not as well regulated as it needed to be, given the large volume of that. And it really put lots of stress on our counties. And one of the things that was very important that we did, they're claiming we're limiting the times that you can vote by mail. The issue was, if people requested a ballot within 10 days of the election, only 52% of those people actually voted. Whereas if they requested them 10 days before that, 92% of them voted. So what we did is we put an absentee ballot deadline in there. And that way the counties can process them. And then if you have time, you then can know you're not going to get a ballot and you can go early vote or vote on election day. So this is about enfranchising people, not disenfranchising people.
Gabriel Sterling, thank you for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you all. You go Dawgs.
During today's Senate hearing about the pandemic, lawmakers leveled tough criticisms at the Biden administration, including around the lack of available testing. The president has announced plans to ramp up the response. That includes requiring insurers to pay for 8 rapid at-home tests per person per month starting this weekend, and making 500 million tests available to ship to those who request them. We look at key questions about all this with Dr. Tom Inglesby. He is a senior advisor to the White House COVID response team. Dr. Inglesby, thank you so much for joining us. The calls for these tests have been out there for a long time. How much difference are these steps the White House has announced going to make?
Judy, thanks so much for having me tonight. Good to be here. The steps that have been announced this week, I think, are going to make a major difference in the availability of over-the-counter tests for Americans. The insurance plan that you just referenced will come into effect this weekend, and every family that's covered by private insurance will be able to access tests on a regular basis for all family members. And then, as you noted, the second part of this new announcement this week is the presidential plan to provide 500 million rapid tests to Americans across the country through a simple website. That will be put in place later in this month. People will begin to be able to be ordering later this month, and tests will start to arrive during January. So those different components of the plan will add to the already growing market of over-the-counter tests in the United States. If you look back at the summertime, we had 25 million tests available to Americans back in August, over-the-counter tests. And in December, we had 300 million tests. And that number is going to grow in January, February, March, and beyond.
In so many words, though, how are you ramping up the supply of tests when we know for the longest time there just have not been anywhere near the number of tests available? How are you suddenly going to make this happen?
Well, the number of tests has been growing over the course of the fall. We've had a number of new manufacturers get their authorization from the FDA in October, November, December. So there are new manufacturers, even right before the holidays, 2 major companies just got their authorization. And they're not even providing tests yet to America, and they will be soon. There are many more companies that have been seeking authorization at the FDA. These announcements have increased the interest in companies making these tests. So we have momentum. We'd like to go faster. We are going to go faster, and we're going to make more tests available.
And how is it going to work for people who are going to want to access these tests through the U.S. Postal Service? They're going to go to a website? I mean, how is that going to work for people?
Exactly. People will be able to go to a website, which will be launched relatively soon, so they'll be able to see it before the time when they can start ordering tests. It'll be a simple, very straightforward website where people will go in and put in their address and say they'd like tests, and those tests will come to them. It will be very straightforward. So that will be happening relatively soon. And
soon, meaning by the next few weeks?
Yes, but the website should be online by this weekend, and then sometime in the days to follow, people will begin to be able to order their tests.
And then how long to receive them?
Tests will begin to arrive during January and then into February.
I'm asking because I did see reporting today that it may take 2 months for these 500 million tests the administration's talking about to reach people.
The details of the timing of their arrival are still being worked out with companies. The contracts are just closing today in the next couple of days. So I think some of the details will be announced by this Friday. But we're going to be getting tests out as quickly as we can as the manufacturers deliver them.
Dr. Inglesby, given that the demand is still going to be exceeding the supply, how are you going to decide who gets the tests that are available? How are you going to prioritize this?
So in this plan to distribute 500 million tests, there are enough tests for every household in America. And so there is no need to make a choice between one household or another. Any household that will want these tests will be able to get these tests. And so as orders come in to the website, we will distribute those tests accordingly, and we will not have a problem in reaching all Americans.
So in other words, there's no plan for prioritization that certain people will have access before others.
Right. This website will provide access to all Americans at the same time. It'll be able to handle a very large load of requests. It's being built to be able to handle a very high volume in the earliest days, when we expect there will be a lot of interest and a lot of demand.
So, for example, individuals of lower income who may not be able to go to the drugstore, afford to get them, to pay for them, they'll be thrown in the mix with everybody else. And everybody will need to have internet access.
So we are very, very conscious of the equity issues involved in having a website like this. There will be a phone line available for people to call in their orders. For people who don't have internet access or have some kind of disability which limits their ability to be on the internet. We also have, it is part of a larger program of testing in the United States. We have a variety of different testing channels that are providing tests for Americans, over-the-counter tests. So, for example, the president announced a commitment last month to provide 50 million over-the-counter tests for free to community health clinics around the country and to rural health clinics. And that is already happening. About 9 million tests have already been ordered by clinics around the country. We will continue to do that. We will continue to provide free testing in pharmacies, in 10,000 pharmacies around the country, which are disproportionately located in underserved communities. So that all those programs will continue as is, but we're adding an additional program here. We also will be making sure to communicate very broadly and carefully with communities that are underserved before this program launches.
And with regard to the announcement about insurers are going to be providing, will be reimbursing to everyone who has insurance coverage, reimbursing what they pay for tests, that obviously doesn't cover all Americans, and it covers people who have insurance. So you're looking at two different buckets of people. Is that how you see it?
Well, in this case, for the insurance program, we've taken a step to cover everyone who has private insurance, which is 150 million Americans. Medicaid providers also have a provision for including over-the-counter tests and providing them for free. There are some states where we're working through prescription, whether someone might need a prescription, but we're hoping that they will be able to access the tests in the same way as anyone with private insurance. And then we also have, and have had in place since the beginning of the administration, a program for the uninsured. So we have a $5 billion program through HRSA to provide coverage of testing for the uninsured. So we're going about this in a variety of ways, consistent with the programs that we have. But yes, the insurance program, for now, that is a private insurance program, but we have other channels for people who are covered in other ways.
Dr. Tom Inglesby, thank you. I know a lot of people have questions, many questions about how this is going to work. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today, after discovering two cases of Omicron, Chinese authorities locked down Anyang, 300 miles from Beijing. It is the third Chinese city in lockdown. The largest is Xi'an, with 13 million people, that shut down more than 2 weeks ago after 120 residents tested positive for Delta, weeks before the Beijing Olympics. These lockdowns are tests of China's zero COVID policy, which authorities have called a success. But critics ask, at what cost? Nick Schifrin reports.
On the streets of Xi'an, the only signs of life are state-mandated COVID tests. As seen on Chinese TV, every resident has to test nearly every day. Xi'an suffering the country's largest community outbreak and its longest lockdown in nearly 2 years. At first, residents were desperate. From their windows, they yelled, "They don't have enough food." Their pleas ignored. A city official says, as long as you have one grain of rice, stay home. Authorities say they've recently made progress delivering groceries, but shortages remain.
Really difficult to find food. It's been difficult to find bottled water. A lot of my coworkers and friends are down to boiling their water.
One American working in Xi'an spoke anonymously for fear of reprisal. He compared his quarantine to solitary confinement.
When you say solitary confinement, what do you mean?
It means that I can't open the door of my apartment. The only time I can leave is to go downstairs and get tested for COVID. That's the only time I can leave. And I tried to go down there when the line is long so I can stay down there as long as possible.
What would happen if you tried to go outside not in the context of getting tested?
I might be arrested. I could be taken to jail, I guess, because this is serious.
Zero COVID can be deadly serious. Hospitals require negative tests for entry. This woman was refused care for 2 hours. She was 8 months pregnant and miscarried. In another video, a woman says her father had a heart attack and died when he was blocked from all of the city's hospitals. And tens of thousands forcibly bused to quarantine centers far from the city center. And now, more cities are under lockdown. Disinfecting trucks are out in Yuzhou after three residents last week developed asymptomatic cases. It's all part of China's zero COVID policy to prevent community transmission. Beijing says it's worked. Cases are far lower than in the West, saving thousands of lives.
We need to try to stay ahead of the virus. We should carry out more strict management in areas with frequent movement of patients and try to control risks at the community level.
At the national level, the top priority is the Olympics. As President Xi Jinping saw last week, athletes and spectators will be kept in a closed loop. Anyone entering the bubble must be vaccinated or face a 3-week quarantine.
They want to make sure there's no major outbreak in the country, right, period, before the Winter Olympics. But in the meantime, they also don't want the zero COVID strategy to fail.
Yinzhang Huang is the Council on Foreign Relations' Senior Fellow for Global Health. He says China wants its COVID policy success to prove the Communist Party's success.
So that can be very convincing, right, in terms of showing case, you know, China's superiority, right, as a successful political system.
But scientists say what's not superior, state-manufactured Sinovac and Sinopharm vaccines. Chinese authorities have voiced concerns their vaccines cannot stop infections despite an 86% vaccination rate.
You know, these two-dose regimen is still not very effective in preventing new infections.
Xi'an's lockdown mirrors Wuhan's 2 years ago. The COVID epicenter was a ghost town. For not wearing a mask, this woman was arrested, and this family dragged out of their home to be quarantined. But one doctor was brave enough to speak out. In December 2019, 34-year-old Dr. Li Wenliang sounded the alarm about a virus spreading between patients. On Chinese social media, he wrote, "I decided to inform my classmates and help protect them." Chinese police later reprimanded him for, quote, spreading rumors. Exactly 2 years ago, he contracted COVID. From his deathbed, he wrote, "Today my nucleic acid test came back positive. The dust has settled." He died a few weeks later. 2 years on, hundreds of thousands of Chinese still write online to Dr. Li's ghost, including from Xi'an.
"When I see that in Xi'an, sick patients are repeatedly turned away from hospitals and die, I vent my fury again and again, because it is just like seeing Dr. Li Wenliang with his foreknowledge. If there is any one lesson we can learn, it should be that we are unable to learn from our past."
Hashtag Xi'an. A man was rejected by three hospitals and died. Who still remembers Dr. Li Wenliang whistling the first whistle? Nowadays, there is no one who dares to whistle.
People relate to him not only because
he's speaking truth and he paid a price. He was being wronged. And also his courage.
Xiao Qiang is the editor-in-chief of the California-based China Digital Times. He says the anniversary of Dr. Li's reprimand and Xi'an's lockdown reveals the true nature of an authoritarian state.
A healthy society should have more than one voice. For even have a reasonable room to have a policy debate about zero COVID policy. None of this existed. Not then and not now. What's happening in Xi'an reminded them the human cost of those rigid top-down authoritarian policy can cause the human suffer in Chinese society.
And now Tianjin, a major port city about 80 miles from Beijing, reported the country's first cases of Omicron. Omicron has led other countries to abandon zero COVID policies, but China is sticking to it, and its low infection rate creates a country more vulnerable to future disease, says Huang.
China will continue to be in that lockdown mode, right? That immunity gap, that will be very dangerous because even a small opening, could lead to a devastating impact. It could quickly overwhelm the country's health system. It could also, because of the fear and panic associated with the disease, it could have social, political stability implications.
Which means even as zero COVID saves lives, it might prove self-defeating. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
With the spread of Omicron exacerbating staffing shortages, returning to school after winter break has been a significant struggle in many parts of the country. The overwhelming number of school districts are back in person, but some have gone virtual for a few weeks. And as Stephanie Tsai tells us, the biggest battle over whether to return to in-person learning has been playing out in Chicago.
Judy, students are expected to return to in-person classes in Chicago tomorrow after nearly a week of canceled classes. The breakdown started last week when the Chicago Teachers Union, or CTU, said teachers would not return in person without better COVID testing and stronger safety protections for staff and students. Mayor Lori Lightfoot and the Chicago Public School District said remote teaching was not an option. Teachers were locked out from virtual accounts and were not paid. Parents have been extremely frustrated with both sides.
My name is Lauren Lehman. My son's name is Bryson Mosley. He is 6 years old and is in first grade at Newfield Elementary.
My name is Allie Ward. This is my husband, Marcus Ward. We live on the north side of Chicago, and we have twin boys who are in the fourth grade in CPS.
My name is Joseph Williams. I am a proud father of five children who attends the Chicago Public Schools, and I reside in the Inglewood community. Last week was very frustrating. As a parent, we had to watch the news to find out if there was going to be school or not. And to have to base a family decision on looking at the news at night to see what's going to happen, I don't think that's fair to families at all.
With Bryson having his ADHD and anxiety, it is much better for him to be in a structured learning environment. It was, for both of us, kind of a constant stop-start all day, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And by the end of the week, we were both mentally and emotionally drained.
They're thinking like, oh, are we flashing back to where we were when we went on spring break and never went back to school? Is this what's going on again?
As parents, we have to adjust to every known variable that's going to happen. So why doesn't CPS have to do that as well? I think it's a poor example for parents and for students who are living through this, certainly. And I think it's hard to know how to explain to your kid what's going on.
Parents' voice was not there. And I feel like we should be at the forefront of these issues. There's no reason why parents aren't at the table. We have folks that are making decisions about our children without us being present.
I don't know how they expect kids to just bounce back mentally, emotionally, academically from a loss of roughly now 4 days worth of education. It's really hard for them. And we're losing sight of that with the constant bickering and back and forth and passing the buck in between CPS and CTU. Enough is enough.
My nephew is in LA. They told the parents about how school would look coming into the new year before they left for Christmas break. If we need to go remote, this is what it'll look like. If we need to go hybrid, this is what it'll look like. And it seems like with our situation is that we are kind of just, we're chasing after answers.
We've gone through this now for almost 2 years, and you didn't think to already have these type of measures in place? Other folks around the world is looking at CPS for guidance, and we can't even do it. We're literally creating things day by day. And these are folks' lives at hand.
I did not think, as the nation's like third largest school district, that we would be going through this much. I would not have anticipated this as a parent, you know, initially coming into the school district. So this is, it's a bit alarming for me, and it kind of makes me question how much longer I really do want to keep him in an environment like this where we could be consistently going back and forth.
The agreement that allows students to return to school tomorrow also sets new guidelines for when they might go back to remote learning. But the mood remains acrimonious between the mayor and the teachers. Here's some of what Mayor Lightfoot and the union's vice president, Stacey Davis Gates, had to say last night.
Some will ask who won and who lost. No one wins when our students are out of the place where they can learn the best and where they're safest. There does come a point where enough is enough. 3 work stoppages in 3 years, of course people are frustrated. Why wouldn't they be? But I'm hopeful that this is the end, at least for this school year.
You have more testing because the mayor was shamed into taking the testing from the governor, who, by the way, offered it months ago. This mayor is unfit to lead this city. And she is on a one-woman kamikaze mission to destroy our public schools. She has not taken good care over the safety of the workers and the students that attended.
And another twist. This afternoon, Mayor Lightfoot announced she tested positive for COVID. She says she's working from home while experiencing cold-like symptoms. For more on all of this, I'm joined by Brandis Friedman of Chicago Tonight on WTTW Chicago. Brandis Friedman, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour on this busy day for you. Did anyone benefit from this 5-day work stoppage in the end? Did the agreement reached lead to concrete safety measures that we will see implemented tomorrow when students go back?
I think the teachers union will say to some degree that they were able to move the ball a little bit and getting a little bit closer to some of what they wanted. They felt like the testing was insufficient in Chicago public schools. And so they will say that since they have finally gotten the district to agree to at least 10% of all students in all schools being tested, that that is something. It is not what they fully wanted. And so the union is taking a bit of criticism from some of its members who don't think this is the best deal that they could have gotten, especially since they were out of school, off of work, not getting paid for five days. So I think with regard to testing, they think they've made some progress. There are some metrics for a school-by-school return to remote learning when it's necessary, which the union asked for. The mayor did hold firm on her position that there would be no metric for a district-wide closure of schools and return to remote learning. So it seems like there were some compromises made on each side.
Brandis, you said there was some agreement that a positivity rate could trigger a return to virtual learning school by school. So does that mean that students and parents could still face more school closures?
If those schools are reaching the metrics, yes, then those schools could experience a return to remote learning. I think the metric is about 40% of students in isolation or quarantine and 30% of teachers who are out of school or in isolation, I should say, and or if 25% of teachers are absent after bringing in substitute teachers, then yes, some schools might experience it. And I'm wondering if it's going to be in the communities that have already experienced a lot of disruption because of their high case rates in those communities.
And some of those same communities may have also experienced the brunt of the learning loss. How is that being addressed by the district?
That has yet to be seen. I think a lot of studies and reports have come out as of late showing that students have definitely fallen behind. And no surprise surprise. Remote learning is hard. And the teachers union has said remote learning is subpar to in-person learning, but in-person learning can be dangerous if the proper mitigation strategies are not in place. And the argument that, you know, the district says we've done X, Y, and Z to make it safer, teachers are saying that is not the lived experience, the reality on the ground that we are experiencing. The other thing here is the number of days that have been missed, those 5 days. It is up to the district now to decide whether or not those days will be somehow made up somewhere else in the school year. And that's 5 days of learning lost.
Just to drive home how contagious Omicron is, now the mayor has it, and everybody that was at that press conference has to be tested for COVID. Teachers and staff are also falling ill to the variant. Is that a problem that's been addressed as students go back?
I don't see it anywhere in this agreement that was just discussed, right? I think they're hoping to implement this new testing as soon as possible. The problem with what has been contentious about the testing plan is that the mayor was firm about not having an opt-out plan. So we've got an opt-in testing system where parents have to opt in to the testing. And so now the teachers union has taken it upon themselves to work with their communities and students and families to get more students signed up so that you can at least reach a large number of students in each school who agree to be tested so that you're not testing the same 10% every time. So as far as folks having been out as of late, the testing that was intended to happen before schools resumed last week, it didn't go well at all. There were pictures of tests stacked up outside FedEx boxes, and a lot of them were deemed invalid. So before they show up tomorrow, any testing that has to happen, that has either already been done or not. School's happening tomorrow, as far as we know today.
Hard choices that a lot of school districts around the country are facing. Brandis Friedman of Chicago Tonight on WTTW. Thank you so much for joining the NewsHour.
My pleasure, Stephanie. Thank you.
As of today, the military detention camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has been open for 20 years. It is an enduring symbol of the American War on Terror, but it's also a symbol for many Americans and worldwide of a grueling, controversial war and a legacy of torture. Amna Nawaz looks now at Guantanamo's history and what's to come as it enters its third decade.
That's right, Judy. On January 11th, 2002, the first 20 detainees arrived at Guantanamo Bay's detention facility. That was 4 months to the day after the September 11th terrorist attacks. And since then, it's held about 780 detainees, and the majority have never been charged. 741 have since been transferred out, and today, 39 men remain. And so, too, do questions about their future and the future of Guantanamo Bay itself, as President Biden renews a pledge to close it. For more on all of this, I'm joined by New York Times reporter Carol Rosenberg. She is the only reporter covering Guantanamo Bay full-time. Carol, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thanks for being here. Let me ask you about those 39 men who are still there. About a dozen or so have been charged, right? The majority of them awaiting trial, including 5 men, we should say, for those 9/11 attacks. But most of the men there, most of them have never been charged. So how is it that the U.S. is still holding them?
So you're correct that there's 6 people that are awaiting death penalty trials, and the majority have not been charged. A few more have been charged through the years. It is essentially was an offshore POW camp in this irregular war on terror. So they call them law of war prisoners rather than POWs. But the concept was not that they were bringing in war criminals. The concept was they were removing people from the battlefield.
And is it also true, we've heard, you know, it's some of these men who haven't been charged will likely never be charged because of the treatment that they've endured while they've been in U.S. custody?
Part of the problem in some cases may be that the evidence is so badly tainted that they can't bring charges against them. There's no clean evidence. But again, these detainees are being held there not as alleged war criminals, but as they call them, law of war detainees. The intention was never to charge the majority of them.
So we should say that a number, as we pointed out, most of them have been transferred out. And critics say if you want to close the camp, you've got to transfer the remaining men out, especially if they've never been charged. So we know the process is they make their case before a review board that has members from six different agencies, including defense and justice and so on. I actually had the chance to sit in on one of those review hearings earlier today for one man who remains in custody. I went to a secure room in the Pentagon. You have a live video link to Guantanamo Bay. You just reported this week on one detainee, a Somali man who I believe is the first high-value detainee who's been approved for transfer out of Guantanamo. Explain to me the significance of that. How big a deal is that?
So first of all, he's now one of 18 men. We had more release decisions, transfer decisions come out today. But the significance of this man, the Somali man, is that they'd never before cleared someone who came straight to Guantanamo from a CIA black site for transfer to another country. And there's a number of those former CIA prisoners who are not charged with crimes. And this suggests that if their CIA at some point had felt that they couldn't ever be released, that some of them might be released. The best known one who's not charged there, I think, is a man named Abu Zubaydah, who's had a hearing, never been charged with a crime. And so there's some expectations that we're going to hear about whether they've decided he can be relocated to another country.
So, Carol, let me just walk you through the timeline for anyone who's been catching up on how this has been open for 20 years. When you look back, January of 2009 is when President Obama, in one of his first executive orders, ordered the closure of Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility within a year. That wasn't able to happen during his presidency. Congress put up a number of hurdles that kept him from being able to move people out. January of 2017, President Trump takes office, reverses that closure order. And then, of course, February 2021, President Biden comes into office the month before and launches a review. He has committed to closing it. But, Carol, you follow this more closely than anyone. Do you see those steps being taken? Could this facility be closed under President Biden?
So, you know, three presidents out of four have said they wanted to close it. For President Bush, it was aspirational. He said, we shouldn't need to do this. For President Obama, it was intentional, meaning the former constitutional law professor was offended by the notion of indefinite detention without charge. President Biden doesn't talk about it that much. We don't know where he lands on the aspirational versus intentional spectrum. You know, he hasn't assigned anyone full time to this task. The argument is that there's so few of them, it can be handled by a number of people in government. But the counter argument is, if you want something done, make someone responsible for it and they can move government. So I think the question is, how badly does he want it? And I think I've told you this before, Amna, closing Guantanamo doesn't mean opening the gates and letting everybody go. It means moving Guantanamo, picking up a number of detainees and taking them to detention facilities in the United States for some sort of similar kind of detention. And right now, Congress won't have it. The law says they can't move them here.
Carol Rosenberg of the New York Times, who follows the proceedings and the ups and downs at Guantanamo Bay more closely than anyone else, a facility that remains open 20 years later to the day. Carol, thank you so much for your time. Always good to see you.
Thank you.
And for more on Guantanamo's legacy, follow us on Instagram. There we examine the detention camp's history by the numbers, including a look at how much it costs to hold each detainee. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.